The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Appreciate all of you being here tonight, and especially our radio listeners and streaming audience at home. A couple of ways that you can join the conversation tonight, of course, is you have been emailing your questions throughout the day. You can also text us on our Big Rock text line, 877-235-9405. We'd love for you to join the conversation. For those of you in Stratton Hall, give yourself a round of applause. What a great crowd we have here tonight. You too can join the conversation. If you have a question, you can text that to me at 877-235-9405. We're so excited to have Dr. Ben Carson with us this evening. Dr. Carson, of course, is a surgeon, author, former presidential candidate, served in President Donald Trump's cabinet as Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. Dr. Carson's incredible life journey out of poverty made possible through the power of education, what we're here to talk about tonight. Also, Senator Jim DeMint, a former board chair at his children's Christian school, businessman turned elected official, represented the 4th District in the U.S. House of Representatives, representing South Carolina in the U.S. Senate. He's a best-selling author, and I can't leave this out, he's a proud granddad as well.
Yeah.
And, of course, Ellen Weaver on our panel tonight, too. A longtime Jim DeMint staffer, founding president of Palmetto Promise Institute, a leading South Carolina advocate for school choice, and the first female chair of the South Carolina Education Oversight Committee. Welcome, all of you, for being part of our panel tonight. Nothing is more foundational to America's future than the education of our children. COVID-19 changed things in a lot of ways, with closings, virtual learning. It opened many eyes to what is happening in education. Parents are finding their voices more than ever before. They're standing up, they're speaking out, even at the risk of being labeled domestic terrorists at times. We'll get back to that in just a moment. Let's start the evening with Dr. Carson, who has such an inspirational story. Share with us, Dr. Carson, the role that education has played in your personal story and why you care so deeply about this issue.
Well, it's a long story, but I'm a surgeon, so I'll cut it. You know, I was, in fact, at one point, a very, very bad student. In fact, everybody used to call me dummy. And the other kids were very glad that I was there, though, because nobody ever had to worry about getting the lowest mark on a test as long as I was there. I took that honor. And I remember once we were having, you know, a discussion in the schoolyard about who was the dumbest kid in the school. It wasn't a big discussion. They all agreed it was me. But but then someone tried to extend the argument to who was the dumbest person in the world. And I said, wait a minute, there are billions of people in the world. And they said, yep, and you're the dumbest one. But I did admire the smart kids, though, secretly. I was always wondering, how could they know so much material? I just don't understand it. You know, my mother was always saying, Benjamin, you're much too smart to be bringing home grades like this. I brought them home anyway, but she was always saying, and she was always encouraging, and but she didn't know what to do. She had less than a third grade education, and she prayed and she asked God to give her wisdom to know what to do. And she started observing the homes that she was cleaning. She was a domestic. And she noticed that they didn't watch a lot of TV and that they read a lot of books. So she came home and imposed that on me and my brother. And we were not happy campers. In today's world, we would have called social services on her. But we had to do it. You know, there's some people who say, you know, particularly a lot of young black males grow up in single parent homes with just a mother, and you know, they suffer from not having an authority figure. I did not suffer from that. You know, if she said you had to read, you had to read. And she made us give her 2 written book reports every week.
Wow.
Which she couldn't read, but we didn't know that. You know, she put a little little check marks and underlines, and we would think she was reading them. She wasn't. But the fact of the matter is, during that time, as I started reading about incredible people, scientists and surgeons and explorers and entrepreneurs, I began to understand what was required for success. And I began to understand that the person who has the most to do with what happens to you is you. It's not somebody else. And I stopped listening to all those people around who were saying, yeah, you can't do this, you can't do that, the society is stacked against you. I just said, forget about that stuff. And my horizons just began to broaden significantly, way beyond Detroit. And I was always reading, and I went from the bottom of the class to the top of the class. Much to the consternation of a lot of the students who used to laugh and call me dummy. Now they were coming to me saying, Benny, how do you work this problem? And I'd say, sit at my feet, youngster, while I instruct you. I was perhaps a little obnoxious. But it sure felt good to say that to those turkeys. But, you know, I had a complete revolution in my thinking. I had the same brain. I was the very same brain. And, you know, I may be fixated on the brain because I just really think it is the most incredible gift that God gave us. A brain with billions and billions of neurons, hundreds of billions of interconnections, the ability to process more than 2 million bits of information in 1 second. Your brain is fabulous. And if you take a human brain and you put it next to an animal brain, let's say a dog, the surface topography is very similar. Frontal lobes, temporal lobes, parietal lobes, occipital lobes, cerebellum, brainstem, midbrain, they all have them. But the dog's midbrain is much better developed than the human midbrain. The midbrain allows you to react. That's why animals react so much faster than people who cat-like reflexes. They can do that. But people have very big, well-developed frontal lobes. Frontal lobe is what allows you to engage in rational thought processing. We have the ability to extract information from the past, mix it with information from the present, project it into the future. We can plan and strategize a year ahead, 5 years, 10 years ahead, very complex thinking patterns. And things like critical race theory, they teach our children to act more like animals, to react to what you're saying, to react to the color of someone's skin or the texture of their hair. When we, as human beings made in the image of God, have a capacity much greater than that, we can analyze the content of one's character. What a difference that makes. And that is a gift that was given to us by God. And once I realized that, I was on my way academically. And, you know, I had a few problems with my temper, but, you know, that's another story.
Senator DeMint, would you like to talk about how education played a role in your success as a business person, as an elected official?
Sure would. I think my brain is more like the dog. But Jane and Joey, it's just great to be here with you, and it's really energizing to see all the people here, and I see it all over the country that the subject of education has got people engaged. And as I've traveled around, there's more interest in school board candidates than there are in congressional candidates in a lot of places, and I've got people who've never run for anything, maybe never worked outside the home, but they're running for school board because they have discovered during this COVID thing what their kids are actually learning. A lot of states that didn't think they were having any trouble with textbooks, like South Carolina and Texas, suddenly they started looking at it and they realized that there was all this nonsense in there that they didn't think was being taught. And so the fact that parents are engaged, that's what we saw in the Virginia governor's election. We're seeing it all over the country. We're seeing it here tonight. But, I mean, education is so foundational. And I've, of course, I've been involved as and when I was in business, I did strategic planning. We did a plan for the Greenville County School District, one of the largest in the state. But I spent 6 months talking to hundreds of teachers, students, administrators, and just getting a consensus of what needed to be done. It was so obvious you just needed to offer as many alternative learning paths as you possibly could because there's so many different learning styles. Students in every class are starting in different places, different aptitudes. But when I presented to the school board, these ideas of how we could create variety and choices within a classroom, within a school district. When I finished, this was 6 months of work, the school board chairman said, "Dement, this is not about choice. This is about control." A lot of my consulting was with competitive companies that had to work every day just to sell products. They didn't. They just wanted to control the situation and sameness was what helped them control. I developed just a passion to change that. I did a lot of volunteer work in the community related to education. I was chairman of the Mitchell Road Christian Academy. All my students went there through the eighth grade, and I've just seen, again, all four of my children learn differently. They needed different types of help at home. So between getting more emphasis on the family and more emphasis on education are the two key issues for me after being in politics for 20 years. I'm tired of being last in South Carolina. I mean, it's not good if American students are doing worse than almost any other industrialized country in the world. And South Carolina is about the worst in this country. And there's no reason for that. There are no obstacles we can't overcome. I'm so excited that Ellen, who is probably the most qualified person I've ever supported for public office, including myself, that is going to take on the education superintendent job in South Carolina. And that gives me hope. That's why I'm coming out tonight.
Yes, yes, thank you, Senator. Ellen Weaver, president of the Pamina Promise Institute, your organization has done a lot of work in the field of education. Talk about what you guys do and your personal experience as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Dr. Pettit, thank you for having us here tonight. I have to say, when I walked in this room, I started sweating bullets, and it wasn't that the air wasn't on. It's that I used to sit about six rows from the back at freshman year at Bob Jones, and the famous Dr. Panosian would say, take out a half a sheet of paper. So a big part of my education journey actually happened in this very room, and education choice is part of my DNA. I'm a product of education choice. I'm so thankful to have my mom and my dad, Mark and Marcia Weaver, here tonight. Mama and Daddy sacrificed to get me the education that I needed. They sent me to a small Christian school. Mama homeschooled me from 6th to 10th grade, and then she said, you know, this high school science and math isn't really for me. You're going to go back to school now. So I graduated from an incredible public school. So I've seen how in my own personal life, being able to get into the right education environment has made such a difference, has opened up so many doors of opportunity for where I am in my personal journey today. And I want that for every kid in our state. And there's no reason why it can't happen. So that's why I'm so excited to be here and have this conversation today. It's why I've spent the last 10 years of my life at Palmetto Promise Institute fighting to expand all forms of education choice in this state. I want to see our public schools thrive, but I also want us to embrace a definition of public education that means an educated public. And that means wherever a student learns best is where they should be. We need an education ecosystem that supports that student's individual needs and learning journey. And I think if there is a silver lining in COVID, in addition to, you know, the engagement that we've seen from parents, people running for school board, it's that we have seen the new opportunities that are ahead of us in terms of how education is becoming unbundled. You don't have to sit in a classroom with four walls around you to get a great education. You can find incredible resources online. We saw parents hiring teachers to tutor, to do pandemic pods. There are so many growing opportunities out there. And I think that the best part about COVID is that parents are stepping up in a way we've never seen before and embracing their role in their child's education. And that's something that we've got to foster here in South Carolina. Our education system can never put our families back together again, but they can be partners to create capacity and engagement within families. And at the end of the day, that's the way we turn education around in South Carolina, is we engage mom and dads in the learning journey of their children.
Thank you. And just a quick reminder to our radio listeners and our streaming audience, if you'd like to ask a question, you can text that to 877-235-9405. I'm so glad to have my friend Jane Robolo from WYFF News 4 here with me. I'm going to let you ask the next question.
Well, I have to say, Joey, thank you. Normally when we are together, you're in a radio studio and I'm putting makeup on in the bathroom. So it's nice to be sitting next to you. Yes. And it's always good to see you. And thank you so much, Dr. Carson, for coming here and meeting and greeting with us. You mentioned critical race theory. And as a journalist, I there are so many inflammatory words that I'm very well aware of now. And you can say critical race theory, and I don't know that people really understand exactly what that means. But I feel like sometimes two people who are, people hear that and they think, oh, well, that means that you don't want to teach segregation or slavery, or that Jim Crow laws happened. You're not saying that we shouldn't teach the dark parts of our past. What's the blend? Where do we teach history accurately and adequately in a way that allows young people to understand mm-hmm. racial sensitivity? And where does critical race theory go off the chart, in your opinion?
That's a very good question. To the extent that my wife and I have a book coming out later on this month called Created Equal: The Painful Past, Confusing Present, and Hopeful Future of Race in America, because it has been used to drive wedges between people in our society. Critical race theory has a tendency to select out a lot of the bad parts of our history and emphasize those without putting them in the proper context. What we need to do is put things in the proper context. Was slavery an abominable, evil institution? Absolutely. No question about it. No excuse for that. But were we the only ones that had slavery? Absolutely not. Virtually every society is familiar with slavery from the beginning of human history. And there are actually more slaves in the world today than there have ever been in history. And when we were talking about human trafficking, the greatest consumer is the United States of America. So do we have some real issues going on here with slavery? Absolutely. But we don't have to go back 200 years to talk about it. It's going on right now. We need to be concerned about the people who are being impacted in this country right now today. Furthermore, you know, when it comes to teaching history, we need to contextualize everything. You know, we have part of American Cornerstone Institute is our Little Patriots program, where you can actually go online and learn about American history in the appropriate context, so you come away feeling proud of our country. We don't try to hide anything, but if there's something that's unique about the United States and slavery. It is that we had so many people who were adamantly opposed to it that we were willing to fight a bloody war and lose a large portion of our population. Nobody else did that. That's what makes us unique. And we should remember that we have that moral fabric that comes from the fact that we believe in God. What does it say in our founding document? It talks about our inalienable rights given to us by our Creator, a.k.a. God. The Pledge of Allegiance to our flag says we are one nation under God. Many courtrooms on the wall, it says, in God we trust. Every coin in our pocket, every bill in our wallet says, in God we trust. And we need to make sure that we embrace those godly principles of loving your fellow man, caring about your neighbor, developing your God-given talents to the utmost so that you become valuable to the people around you, having values and principles that govern your life. Those are the things that made America into a great nation. How did we go from a ragtag bunch of militiamen to the pinnacle of the world in record time? It was not a coincidence. It was because we believed in those founding principles of faith, which taught us how to relate to our fellow man. It said, love your neighbor, not cancel your neighbor. And, you know, the principle of liberty, freedom. You know, think about freedom of speech and how important that is. And yet, there are some who say, well, we have freedom of speech in our country. Do we? When big tech and the media can cancel people and threaten people, and you have a complicit government, then that is exactly the same as if the government was imposing restrictions on your speech. That is going on in our country today, and we can't stand for it, because if we allow it to spread, it will impact every aspect of our lives, and it's going to be the people. Don't expect the government to protect your rights. Governments do what governments do. They're just like lions. Lions are not bad animals because they kill gazelles and eat them. They do that because they're lions. What do governments do? They grow, they infiltrate, and they dominate, and they control. And our founding fathers understood that after studying every government that ever existed. And that's why they gave us a constitution, so that the people would have the means to control the government. But we have to understand what it says, and we have to have the courage to exercise it. And then, you know, community, such an important part of who we are as Americans, the ability to work together. You know, in this country, early on, you had communities that existed of 20 families, 50 families, 100 families, different skills, different talents, but they were able to combine those to work together with synergy and to coalesce. And that's a big part of the strength that we had. And then life, our respect for life, from the womb to the tomb. And as we've grown away from respecting life, we've grown away from respecting each other. So we need to teach all of these things. We need to teach these principles to our children. We cannot stand by like wallflowers while we allow people who don't have those beliefs. And that's one of the reasons that I'm here, because I know that Ellen Weaver has those beliefs. And I encourage people, when you go to vote, make sure you know who you're voting for. Make sure you actually study them. Don't just go into that booth and look for a name that looks familiar. You know, that's the way a lot of people are. I recognize that name. It could be Satan. They say, yeah, I know that name. In some cases, it is. And so make sure you understand who it is you're voting for, because putting the right people in the right positions will make all the difference in the world.
And Senator DeMette, to go back to something that you had said about school choice, is it choice or is it control? I think that's a great question. But you also said that people are now really focusing as much on who's running for school board as they are who's running for Congress.
Yeah.
Is that a great place for families to start? I mean, is this kind of the great awakening for parents to just not think of school perhaps as daycare for their kids while they go off and do their things, but to actively become involved in what their child is learning in school, whatever you believe. What is my child learning in school? And then how can I, as a parent, support my schools?
Well, it's a great question and a good perspective in a sense, because I think a lot of us for years just did just what you suggested, is we put our kids in the school we trusted that everything was okay, and we went and did whatever else and then got them after school. I just think over the last few years, for a lot of reasons, things have been exposed about what's really going on. And things have, I think, actually gotten worse, because instead of managing schools for education purposes, there's a lot of political management now and ideology that has nothing to do with creating opportunities for the children. And I think parents have gotten a glimpse of that a lot through the homeschooling and online learning that happened during COVID, and just revealing what's in textbooks, what they hear teachers say online. And it's been startling to a lot. And I know if you're in a nice suburb here in Greenville, and they've got a, you know, real modern elementary school down the street, it's clean, and you go visit and you think everything's okay. But there's so much behind that now, and particularly things like critical race theory that are so detrimental in the sense that you're telling the kids that to, in effect, hate each other, or that there's racism there instead of the unity that needs to be taught. And so, yeah, I'm excited whenever the people get engaged to change the government. That's when change happens. And so it's a little bit of the Tea Party sense here, except it's just more focused. It's focused on one issue. It's children, parents, and education.
Excellent. Thank you. Ellen Weaver, you've talked about that you're a graduate of public schools and then graduate of Bob Jones University as well. I think sometimes, again, in the media, listening for those words that can sometimes be triggering to people, I want to say in the local media, maybe. Sometimes when people hear school choice, they automatically assume that means anti-public school. Yeah. Where do you land on that?
It's an excellent question, and I think that for too long we have let people who have a vested interest in the power structure that currently exists define what school choice means to too many people. So let's be clear, we're spending billions and billions of dollars on public education here in South Carolina. On average, we're bringing in over $15,000 a student. The problem in our public education system is not money, it's how the money is being spent. And so, I believe allowing even a portion of that money to follow a student to the education environment of their parents' choice just makes common sense. And, you know, folks will try to paint this as some kind of radical right-wing conspiracy to destroy public education, quote-unquote. But nothing could be further from the truth, and we actually have actual examples of where it's working. I love to talk about Florida. So Florida has some of the oldest and largest choice programs in the country. They've been doing this for about 20 years now. And not only are the children who are able to participate in these programs flourishing, so these are children typically who are lower income, potentially English language learners, or have some kind of special need or disability, not only are those children thriving, the children in the public education system are doing better. And why is that? Because a rising tide lifts all boats. Competition works when you let it. And it's not just competition for students and for families. It's really about empowering teachers. Think about a market for teacher talent, where a teacher has a choice about the kind of culture and the kind of environment that he or she gets to work in. This is really about empowering the people in the education system who matter most, which is our students, our parents, and our teachers. And so that's why I believe school choice, I like to call it education freedom. We're here tonight to talk about education freedom. That's really what we're talking about, is the ability of every student to get into the education environment that allows them to learn and to fulfill their highest God-given potential.
Ellen, I'm going to stay with you. I'd like for you to talk a minute about Palmetto Promise Institute and your recent collaboration with Senator Tim Scott. What a wonderful story. And if you don't know the story, I want you to tell part of it there, but I want you also to be sure to make a note to go to palmettopromise.org and watch the story about the Artist Ware Center for Education Opportunity. It's an inspiring story, but talk with us about that collaboration.
I'd love to, because, you know, Senator Scott's story, much like Dr. Carson's mm-hmm. story, that's why we do this. That's why it matters, because we have children in our classrooms who are being told they don't have potential and that they can't achieve. For too long, Senator Scott was one of those children, and he tells the story about his grandfather. You know, his father left the family when I believe the senator was about 7 years old. So they moved in with his mom's parents. And every morning at the breakfast table in this little tiny house in North Charleston, one of the poorest areas in the Lowcountry, his granddad would sit at the table, the breakfast table, every morning reading the newspaper. And Senator Scott always has said, why was he doing that? I don't understand. It wasn't until the senator was much older that he realized his granddad couldn't read. But he wanted to provide an example for his grandsons of the power of education. And look at the lives that Senator Scott has impacted through the example of his grandfather. And so when we thought about the work that we do at Palmetto Promise Institute, we have been supporters of education freedom, but we've also worked extensively on ideas to improve our traditional public school system. We couldn't think of anyone who more embodied the spirit of our work than Senator Scott's grandfather. And so we were honored the senator collaborated with us to name that center in his honor. And I hope that it will be a lasting legacy in South Carolina for the story of a man who has done incredible things and who has given us Tim Scott.
Yep. Thank you. Nice. Another quick reminder to our radio audience and our streaming audience, you can text questions, and we're getting a lot of interaction here, 877-235-9405. I'd like to take a question that's actually from Stratton Hall here, from the mayor of Honeypath. Mayor Chris asked Dr. Carson, as the former HUD secretary, as a mayor of a small town, what's your advice on providing affordable housing, and how does that relate to education as well?
Okay. Well, you know, affordable housing was an area where we put a great deal of emphasis, and we're able to work across party lines in a number of places where we had public-private partnerships to try to create the right kind of housing. And mixed-income housing, mixed-purpose housing seems to work very well. But one of the biggest barriers to affordable housing is the regulatory barriers. We've made a lot of progress in terms of the technology of construction, but we have not made much progress in terms of getting rid of all the monstrous regulations. You can have a place, for instance, in California that you might be able to build for $175,000, but by the time you get through with, you know, the noise restrictions, the height, the density restrictions, the environmental restrictions, you know, the list is as long as your arm. That $175,000 has turned to $600,000. And it becomes very, very difficult to put people into housing in situations like that. So we've got to have, you know, rule makers who take all that into consideration, who consider the safety issues, who come up with innovative ways to take care of the safety issues, and things that actually make sense, and things that take advantage of the various technologies that have emerged, which make some of the rules of the past no longer important. You know, I was flabbergasted by the number of rules that existed when I got there. We got rid of over 2,000 regulations and sub-regulations. And that made it much easier to work with people who were the grantees. And when we first got to HUD, First of all, I had no assistant secretaries for 5 months and no deputy secretary for 8 months. I think they thought that maybe if they didn't give me anybody, I would go away. But, it didn't quite work that way. But the books, there had not been an audit for several years. It's required that every federal agency have an annual audit. They couldn't do an audit because there were so many material defects. So, you know, job one was to find a super auditor. We managed to get a senior person from Ernst & Young, 37-year veteran, who didn't want to come, but we just bothered them until he finally decided it was better to come. And he and his team were able to really straighten up. You could see you never heard those stories anymore the last few years about the malfeasance at HUD. You may start hearing them again soon. But you didn't hear them. And it was because of the way that they fixed things up. And that, in turn, gave us the ability to be able to work with grantees much more easily. And we had real-time evaluation of where the money was going, how it was being spent. And, unfortunately, we didn't have another term to do some other things. But what's going on right now with a lot of things in our society, with, you know, Putin troubles, with inflation problems, with energy prices, with craziness in our school systems, with border security, all of these things are self-inflicted wounds. They didn't have to be going on. And they say it's always darkest before the dawn. So it's pretty dark. So I think the dawn is coming. But it has a lot to do with us. It has a lot to do with the American people recognizing that we, the American people, are not each other's enemies. And we should stop allowing the purveyors of hatred and division to succeed in our society.
Dr. Carson, if we can stay with you for a moment there. I mean, it just strikes me as we're all familiar with your amazing story through Gifted Hands, the book and the movie, and to see what you were able to achieve as such a pioneer in the field of neurosurgery. And then you shot yourself like an arrow straight into the bureaucracy of Washington, D.C. So I feel like your observations are particularly keen, because you're looking at Washington from a completely different perspective, and that's an outsider. Feel free to walk down that path, but you gave us a great challenge just now. Let's see each other as Americans. How do we begin to do that? You've got a room full of people and a huge radio audience right now. You are a pioneer in one of the toughest fields in medicine. Help us. How do we all get on the same page? Not agree with each other. That's just never going to happen. But how do we all get on the same page behind that flag to your right?
That's a very good question. You know, how did I end up in politics? You know, if you'd asked me 10 years ago, would you end up in politics, I would say, you're absolutely crazy. There's absolutely no way I would go into that. Because, you know, they call Washington a swamp. I call it a cesspool. There are some good people there. This man right here was a spectacular. He's someone that I consult with frequently. He has a lot of wisdom about what's going on there. But it was disheartening to see that there were so many people who were self-centered, who really were not that interested in serving the constituency that they had, were more interested in gaining power unto themselves. And, you know, how do we as a nation get above that? Well, I mentioned one thing already, and that's so important, that we, the people, the citizens, take a real special interest and one of our most sacred duties, and that's voting. We can change the people who represent us, but we have to know how they represent us. Are they being good representatives? Because you can see elections have consequences. And, you know, you put, you know, I love to hear the economists. They say, you know, the economy has a natural ebb and flow. It gets better and it gets worse, and it's sort of a natural pattern. There's nothing natural about it. Sometimes we have people in office who understand how to do things, and sometimes we don't. That's why it goes up and down. But it is we, the people, who have to solve this problem. Every single one of us has a sphere of influence, and we decide what happens in that sphere of influence. We decide how to treat other people. And I'd like us to all do one thing right now. Take the niceness pledge. Just raise your right hand. Take the niceness pledge. Now, you can put your hand out. What have you just pledged to do? You're going to be nice to every single person you encounter for 1 week. Okay? That includes spouses. Okay? And what that means is no talking about other people behind their back for a week. Now, I know some people will stroke out, but just so you can, okay? And you see somebody struggling with something, you're going to help them. Men, we're going to hold the chair for the lady and open the door for the ladies. Ladies, we're not going to curse them out when they do that. There's a bunch of people waiting to get on the elevator. You're going to let somebody else get on. And when you get on, don't act like you never saw the numbers change before. Speak to people. You know, you may have to practice CPR, but speak to people. And, you know, you're going to get in your car. The parking lot is jammed full of people. You see three people follow you in their car because they want your space. When you get in the car, don't pull down the mirror and open the glove box. Just get out of the space. You don't have to revel in your power. But what are you doing during that week? Thinking about others first. That is the real key. That's how we solve a lot of these problems. That's what the Bible means when it says, love your neighbor as yourself. We need to bring that back. We can't let those people who are trying to divide us succeed. Because what they know is that the United States of America is too powerful to be brought down by China or Russia or Iran or North Korea, but it can be brought down from inside. And that's what Jesus meant when he said, a house divided against itself cannot stand. Abraham Lincoln echoed that, and it is absolutely true. So we ultimately are the ones who decide what kind of nation we have.
Okay, Dr. Carson, I think you tricked me there, because I took the niceness pledge. I sit for 3 hours every morning and take radio callers. They're not always nice, but I'm going to be nice for the next week.
Well, but Dr. Carson said don't talk about them behind their back, so you can talk about them right in front of them, Joe.
That's good. Senator DeMint, you were an early advocate of charter schools. 25-plus years ago, talk with us why you felt that was so important.
Well, it fits into just the need to create different alternatives for students with different learning styles and interests and aptitudes. And we saw that in public schools that, again, they wanted more control than they wanted to offer choices, although there were AP classes and some things developing. But we could see that if a student wanted to specialize in arts or math, or the technologies, that the ability of a charter school to have more flexibility, more parental involvement, more apprenticeships, but charter schools are public schools. And what one of the things I like about the idea of education scholarship accounts, where the money follows a student, is every school becomes a public school when a child and a parent can pick any school and have the money provided through the public funding that they could go. Every church in South Carolina could have a little elementary school if they wanted to. And so the charter schools, we've seen it develop. There have been some really good ones. Ellen mentioned some of those. Some that weren't so good, they've lost their charter and gone out of business. That's the way it should be. And it has created some competition for just the traditional public schools, and some of them have gotten better because of that. But there is so much resistance even for that. The Biden administration is trying to do things through the Education Department to make it harder for charter schools. We've had a number of people in South Carolina who did not want them to expand, even though we see states where charter schools flourish, where the students do better. And Ellen mentioned a really important point that we don't talk about enough. Choices in schools would make teaching a profession again and not just be a government bureaucrat. The best teachers would be plucked out by the best schools to teach, and they would have so many more opportunities to teach online, to teach in person, to teach near their homes, to teach in a Christian environment if they wanted to. And if there's anything that we go to the mat for as voters, as Christians, as Americans, it would just be the more education choices. And Jane, you ask a great question. It's a myth that's out there that if you're for choice, you're against public schools. But we've got data from states all around the country where the more choices in the states, the better the public schools become. And so that is a myth. And if you want to help public schools, just expand the choices.
Excellent. Ellen, Senator DeMint just touched on teachers, and we talked about critical race theory. And do you feel like teachers are getting squeezed? They hear one thing from the parents and there's hearing another thing from society. Are good people still interested in teaching? I don't want our public school teachers or private school teachers, either one, to listen to this and feel like they're being maligned in any way. Are you hearing from them? Do they feel like they're getting support from parents, from school boards, from local and state politicians?
Well, Ellen talks to a lot more teachers now than I do, so I'll let her answer it. But what we've got great teachers, and many of them feel throttled, feel like they can't teach what needs to be taught. They of course, they've got the textbooks provided by the system, and sometimes that curriculum is not what those teachers want. I mean, there's so many exceptional teachers that I think they would like more alternatives. But I don't think a lot of them feel that supported now. They're getting blamed for a lot of that the bureaucracy actually causes. And it's not them, for the most part, that want to teach critical race theory or want to teach all this other weird stuff to kindergartners. It's generally something that's coming from a wild school board in San Francisco or something else. But Ellen, let me toss this to you, because I know you've been in a whole lot of schools in the last few years and talked to a lot of teachers.
Absolutely. Well, I think that, you know, we have to recognize teachers are tired. They are just worn out. COVID was hard on everybody. It was hard on parents. It was hard on teachers. I particularly feel for principals who are often squeezed between the parents and the teachers on one side and the superintendent on the other side, right? You want to talk about a no-win situation. And so I think our entire system is just exhausted. And I think because of what we have seen happen during COVID, whether it was fighting to keep kids in masks, fighting to keep classrooms closed because of politicization of science, I think teachers feel discouraged. And we see it, you know, we are having trouble recruiting new teachers to come into the classroom. We're having trouble retaining teachers who are already in that classroom. And so I think one of the huge challenges that we're going to face here in South Carolina is, how do we restore trust through transparency? I believe we have got to be completely transparent about all of the curriculum and materials that is in our classroom. I believe we have to be completely transparent for every single dime of spending. And there are ways for us to do this. We have the technology to do it, but we just haven't had the will to do it to this point. And so I think that, the best thing that we can do to support teachers to help rebuild that trust that is lacking right now is to open the doors of our schools to our communities, especially our faith communities, to create organized ways for them to engage in supporting teachers in the classroom, in supporting students in their learning. We just had an incredible opportunity to visit with a local church here in Greenville today who has been providing summer tutoring services for their local Title I elementary school for, you know, 10 years now. And that grew into them developing education pods during COVID, where they had pods in 10 of Greenville's poorest neighborhoods, making a real difference, taking students who were failing and turning them into A&B students and totally changing their life in the process. And so I think about the need that we have in our schools right now. I mean, two-thirds of our children are not reading and doing math on grade level. That is a systemic crisis. How do we begin to address it? I think about, you know, a historical illusion, the Marshall Plan that rebuilt Europe. We need a Marshall Plan to rebuild education in South Carolina. And so I just fundamentally believe that inviting our communities into our classroom, creating new ways for parents to engage in this process, to see what's happening in the school, to support teachers, I think that's how we begin to address some of the woke nonsense that is in schools. Because when you have members of the community in the classroom, suddenly they're going to be a lot more careful about what they're teaching. And I want to make one more point to that, Jane, before I turn over the mic. We have incredible teachers in our classrooms who just want to teach. Mm-hmm. They are scared and they are intimidated. And I want to be able to support those teachers to give them a voice at the highest levels of our government here in the state of South Carolina to say, I hear you, I see you, I will stop the woke professional development that is being pushed on you as a teacher. So those are just some ideas about ways that we can support our teachers. I could go on for hours, but I'll stop.
Back to you, Dr. Carson. You've written a number of books over the years. One of those was a children's book, Why America Matters. Why did you feel that was an important book to write?
I think it's so important because there is a desire by many to indoctrinate our children. Now, children's minds are very, very impressionable. They're developing very rapidly. Most people don't know this, but their brain continues to develop until your mid to late 20s. So that's why your teenagers act the way they do. But the fact of the matter is, I recognize that so many of our children were getting the wrong information and therefore getting the wrong impression about the country that we live in. We live in an amazing place. You know, I have visited 68 countries. I have lived overseas. And I can tell you, there is no place like our country. We should be very proud of it. You know, you had people trying to denigrate America and saying it's a systemically racist country and we're full of horrible people. But if it was so bad, why would people be forming caravans trying to get in here? And when they got here, they'd be saying, oh, it's a horrible place, don't come. But that's not the case, because it's a wonderful place. And I wanted our children to really be able to see that. We have beautiful pictorial illustrations. And on each page, the guide is Liberty Eagle. And the thing that we point out to the children is Liberty Eagle has a left wing and a right wing. Can't fly with two left wings and can't fly with two right wings. But when they work together, can soar majestically. And that is what can happen to our country, too.
Thank you. Senator DeMint, you served on the Education and Public Works Committee when you represented the 4th District in the U.S. House. You took a tough vote against No Child Left Behind, one of President George Bush's key legislative priorities. Can you give us some background on your vote, why you voted that way, and has the role of the federal government in education gotten better or worse since that vote?
Well, that was an interesting story because I was a fairly new congressman at the time. George Bush was in the White House, so I was pushing against the president and the majority. But actually, the way the bill started out, it had a provision in there where states could opt out and effectively become charter states. And in effect, they get the federal money, but they agree to certain standards, but then they do it their way. And I was willing to see the thing go through because of that. But to get Senator Kennedy in the Senate and some of the other Democrats to vote for it, Bush took that out. And when he did, you know, I came out with the infamous phrase that this is a no Democrat left behind bill. And within a few hours, I was called to the White House where I think it was my first trip to the Oval Office where it was George Bush and Dick Cheney and nobody else. And it was one of those things where Cheney was trying to intimidate and Bush was trying to be nice. But, you know, I'll just tell you one interesting thing, growing up the hard way. My only thought when I was sitting there being, you know, grilled in the light that all kinds of bad things were going to happen to me if I didn't vote for the bill, I came up a little bit of the hard way, too, not quite as hard as you, but my mother was meaner than anything I'd ever worked with. The only thing I could think about is, you know, my mother could kick your rear end. And, you know, I didn't say it, but I just thought this beautiful peace came over me. These guys don't scare me at all. So there's some benefits to coming up with the hard way when they won't scare you at all. But the bill just created a lot more paperwork. One of the things that drives teachers crazy is all the time they have to spend on paperwork. And if you check on it once you get to D.C., a lot of that comes and never is read. None of it, but they spend hours and hours, and that's why you can't keep a lot of good teachers because they spend so much time with paperwork and bureaucracy and not doing what they want to do, love the kids and teach them. So it really turned out like I thought. It created more bureaucracy, more paperwork, and it just didn't help. If I had to make one point tonight, I've worked at the federal level for over 20 years in different capacities, And I've also worked around the country. We've done it here with Palmetto Promise. I'm on Ellen's board. I'm also on Dr. Carson's board. But all we're doing now in Washington as conservatives is just trying to minimize the damage, try to slow down what's happening there. Because even when the pendulum swings, we still spend more and borrow more. But the good things that are happening in our country are happening at the local and state levels, particularly when it comes to education. There are so many states now who've done different versions of education savings accounts or scholarship accounts, different ways to offer more choices. And if that continues to grow, it's going to force the federal government to get out of the state's business. Because I can tell you with good authority that federal programs are not going to improve education. They're just going to put more red tape on it. What we're doing here is so important across the country. Just recognize that, whether it's energy, whether it's the economy, whether it's just expanding an understanding of how important the Christian faith is to the infrastructure of our country. And we can do that at the local and state level. And the other thing I'd leave you with is you can do more good outside of politics than you can do inside politics, mm-hmm. whether it's with churches and business and volunteer organizations. I mean, we've got to have good people who are willing to get in the arena, and we've got some of them here at the state legislature tonight. But don't ever think that we have to look to politicians to fix things, because the more we do ourselves, the better it's going to get done.
One quick follow-up there, Senator. I'd like to give you a minute or so to talk about the work that you're doing now, the Conservative Partnership Institute, CPI.org, and just tell us in general terms what you've
got. Joey, thank you. I don't want to do too big of a commercial here, but after serving and being on the inside and just seeing the intimidation, the pressure that comes when you're trying to do the right thing, and I started Senate Conservatives Fund and other groups to try to elect good people. We were very successful, particularly in years like 2010 and the Tea Party. But most of those people who came to Washington were beat down, and everybody around the country just keeps asking, what happens to good people when they get there? You know, they just don't seem to follow through. It's just because everything in Washington pushes in the wrong direction, and there's no reward for doing the right thing. And so when I left Heritage, I realized that they don't need more research and white papers on the Hill. Information's not the problem. We need a real support system for the conservatives. And the Conservative Partnership was formed just to get the backs and support the good members of Congress and their staff, to get conservative groups to work better together, to partner with them. So we have a location a couple blocks from the Capitol where Freedom Caucus meets, the conservatives from the Senate meet. We help identify and place great staff, because a lot of the members go bad because they have bad staff around them that want to be lobbyists someday. We train the staff on how the place works so that they can use the power of parliamentary procedures to help their member get things done. And a lot of we provide office space for a lot of great groups, including like American Cornerstone and a lot of the new groups that we help to start up. We don't want to be big. We want to just keep good people like Dr. Carson on the playing field. But just a little help in legal work and office space and a little fundraising, mm-hmm. and the good people do the rest by themselves. And so you've probably seen Stephen Miller on television with the shaved head, America First Legal. He's suing the administration every time they do an executive order. American Accountability, we helped them start. They're really digging into a lot of these nominees, and a lot of them have had to drop out because of the truth was found out. So that's my passion now. I feel like I'm doing more good than I've ever done just by helping the people who are willing to fight. We're doing that at the state level now. We've got started a Freedom Caucus here in South Carolina. Their new chairman here and several of the members, which has been really encouraging to me. With a state with a Republican majority like we've got, we should have school choice like that. We should have energy competition. So hopefully we'll see a difference here. But we've got to support the good folks who are willing to take a stand, because there is no reward for doing the right thing in politics unless the people get their backs.
Yeah. Dr. Carson, we had a question earlier from the mayor of Honeypath asking about housing and urban development, because clearly good housing, safe housing, clean housing is important to a child in every aspect, even including education. So is health and medical. Boy, and that seems to be the big boondoggle right now, doesn't it, in Washington, D.C., is there is no good comprehensive health care plan. As a doctor, you've seen everything from A to Z, I'm sure, in terms of patients. Is it possible, or as Jim DeMint suggested, maybe that doesn't happen at the federal level. Maybe states need to be tasked with that. Or is it even anything we politicians should consider?
Well, you know, what do you have that's more important than your health? Nothing. I mean, if you had a choice of $1 billion, but you had to be quadriplegic, or you'd be penniless, but you'd be healthy. I don't think that would be a hard choice for many people. But so we do need to make sure that health care is available to people. It's not a right, but it is a responsibility for a responsible society, and we are a responsible society. So we should be investing some intellectual capital into figuring out how to make it work. There are other places around the world where it works. We spend $11,800 per year per capita on health care in this country. That's a lot of money. Can you imagine if you use that in an effective and an efficient way? And, you know, what I've talked about is having health savings accounts. If we gave everybody a health savings account with that kind of money in it that continues to accumulate, if you don't use it all in one year, it rolls over to the next year. And when you die, you can pass it on to a relative. So you can imagine in a couple of generations what people's, you know, accounts would look like. Every family would be its own health insurance company. And you would be very careful about your health in those situations because you got to pay for it if things don't work out. But you also give families the ability to shift money between their health savings accounts. So, you know, if your husband is $500 short, you know, you can give him $500 out of yours. That way, if Uncle Joe is smoking two packs of cigarettes a day, everybody's going to hide his cigarettes. They don't want that coming out of their account. We start paying a little closer attention. But the way the system works now with insurance, it's sort of like you go to a hotel, you put your credit card down, and they say, oh, you don't need that. All your expenses are taken care of. Oh, really? Oh, well, what's on the room service menu? And whereas if you got to pay for it, is there a McDonald's nearby? So, you know, you're taken care of either way. Your belly's full, but one costs a whole lot more money than the other. And we start paying careful attention to what we're doing. And that's really the secret. You know, as long as somebody else is responsible and we're not taking care of it, we're not going to be very efficient in the way that we do things. So it can be done. And I don't think that's a partisan issue either.
Is anybody listening to you talking about this health savings account?
No.
are we listening? Yeah. That's excellent. Great idea.
They tell me that we need to start wrapping up here in just a few minutes. So let's kind of get back to where we were on education. We've discussed a lot of challenges that South Carolina is facing, a lot of challenges our nation is facing. But with all the, even with all the challenges that we've talked about, I've heard a message of hope as well. So I'd like for each of you, and I'm going to start with Ellen, to talk a little about where you see the future goes, what hope you see, and then Senator DeMint and Dr. Carson, if the two of you would also follow.
Absolutely. Well, it has been a joy and a privilege to be here with you tonight. When I think about the hope that we have in education, it's sitting in this room right here. It's the fact that we have hundreds of people who would come out on, what is it, a Monday night or a Tuesday night? I don't even know what day it is or where I am, but I think it was a Monday night, to listen to a conversation about education in South Carolina. I mean, nothing is more foundational to our future. A good education allows you to get a good job, which allows you to support a family. And if you do those things in that order, you have less than a 2% chance of living in poverty. So education is so foundational to everything that we do in this state. And the stakes are high. We are literally fighting for the heart and soul of our country. We're fighting for the hearts and the minds of children that God created in His image. But there are people like you around this state who are engaged and who are stepping up to the plate and saying, here am I, send me. And that is what it is going to take to turn education around, not just here in South Carolina, but in America. You know, our state motto is while we breathe, we hope. But a lot of times people don't know we have a second motto, prepared in mind and resources. We're not just hoping. We go out and we get to work. And so that's what we're going to have to do over the next few years if we are going to ensure that every child in our state gets an excellent education that allows them to fulfill their God-given potential.
Oh, you want to close, right? Well, I can't tell you how much fun this is for me to watch Ellen go through a statewide campaign. She was one that was scheduling me when I was running for the Senate to those 16-hour days where you got to be in Myrtle Beach in the morning and Greenville, South Carolina at night and then drive all over. Now she's doing it, and I'm watching. And but she's, I think you're doing it better than I am, and that's great. No, I think what Ellen said is true, is if our hope is in the political leadership, our hope is in vain, really. It's, you know, my hope is that God will keep his hand on this country and that won't pull it away because of what we see going on here. And I hope it'll be like Sodom and Gomorrah, where, hey, if we can find 10 good people here, God's going to give us another few years. He's going to spare us. But that's important for us to have hope, to realize where it comes from. And we talk about education freedom. Ben mentioned this too. You know, Jesus tells us how you get freedom. You got to know the truth. And if you follow God's word, you'll know, you'll be a disciple and you'll know the truth, and the truth will set you free. Amen. So if you want to reverse. Amen. And while our intent's not to demand that of others, I think if we share that hope, and if we keep trying to create opportunities for children to be educated and grow up in an environment where they know there is a God that loves them and that created this earth, and that's why everything makes sense if you understand that, that's where we can have hope that's real. And when good people get engaged in not only just the local process, it's a lot of what Dr. Carson's doing through American Cornerstone, and it's just reminding people how important family and community is to liberty and life. And that's a responsibility that we take as citizens. Jane, I'm very hopeful, because whenever I see people say, wait a minute, this doesn't make sense, I know something's going to change. And people are getting more active. They're doing what Dr. Carson said, finding out more about how the parties are really voting, because there are a lot of people who've been voting for a certain party just because their grandmother did or something they've been told. I think as a Christian, if you look at it, it becomes pretty evident that there's nothing perfect there, but there is a direction that is much more consistent with biblical principles that we need to look for. And then hold these folks accountable, but support them when they do the right thing. I wouldn't still be doing this and traveling around and getting on airplanes, living out of a suitcase, if I didn't think that stakes were high, that the time is critically important, and that every one of us can make a difference.
I should have let you close.
You can ask the benediction there.
Well, it's been an honor to be here with Senator DeMint and Ellen Weaver. We got some tremendous representatives here in the state of South Carolina. But let me just close by finishing what I was saying about Alexis de Tocqueville when he came and saw how wonderful our system of government was, our system of business, our system of education. He thought it was spectacular. But he said the thing that impressed him more than anything else were the fiery sermons that came from the pulpits every Sunday, and how those sermons gave a ragtag bunch of militiamen the ability, the courage, and the strength to defeat the most powerful military force on the face of the earth, but it also gave the people of America a moral foundation, a sense of right and wrong, a sense of good and evil. And he concluded his two-volume set, Democracy in America, with these words: America is great because America is good. And if America ever ceases to be good, she will cease to be great. Let us make sure that America is good.
Amen. Yeah.
That was good. Thank you. That was a great debate.
My kind of debate. Thank you, Dr. Price. I really appreciate it.
Okay, Joey, thank you. You're still on the air? Yeah, it was so good to see you.
Oh.
We're going to thank our radio audience and our streaming audience for being with us. We're going to say goodbye to our radio audience now. Let me ask you to join me each weekday, 6 a.m. to 9 a.m. for the Morning Answer. For those of you in Stratton Hall, a special thank you to a few of our sponsors, CNC Indoor Range. Blythe and Leslie are here. Some of you, you have a gift under your seat, so just before you leave, check under your seat. There's a gift card under there, and also there'll be gift bags as you leave this evening as well with some promotional discounts there. And if you would, please keep your seat because I'm going to turn it back over to Nate Lloyd.
We've got a couple more things, so if you could please remain in your seats. We couldn't do any of this.
And that concludes the Answer's Evening on Education Freedom event here at Bob Jones University. Special thanks to our guests, Dr. Ben Carson, Senator Jim DeMint, and Ellen Weaver. All of those in attendance and all who tuned in tonight. And, of course, thanks to tonight's sponsors, the Prosperity Group, the Upstate's premier retirement financial advisors, and CNC Indoor Range, the Morning Answer's official gun shop. Now, back to 94.5 The Answer's regular programming.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.